Welcome to Season 4 of the Unscripted Podcast, a podcast by medical students about living and learning at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we host a variety of discussions such as navigating the preclinical and clinical years, exploring humanism in medicine, and developing our physician identities outside of the textbook.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter at @unscripted_med. We'd love to hear from you, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. My name is Andrew Zahn. Today, we will be discussing an article published in the New England Journal of Medicine just this last February. It's titled Protecting the Legitimacy of Medical Expertise, and it addresses misinformation in medicine and current trends in the regulation of the medical profession. And so our guests today are the authors of that article, Professor Carl Coleman and Dr. Richard Barron. So I'm thrilled that we were able to get all three of us on at the same time, especially with your busy schedules. Do you mind introducing yourselves and giving your background to everyone?
Thanks, Andrew, for inviting us. I'm Richard Barron, currently President and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine and the ABIM Foundation. This is after a career of 30 years in community practice in the community in which I lived, internal medicine and geriatrics in Philadelphia, a few years with the federal government at the Innovation Center, overseeing programs of primary care and new ACO models. And I've been at the American Board of Internal Medicine, the ABIM Foundation, almost 10 years.
And I'm Carl Coleman. I'm a professor of law at Seton Hall Law School, where I teach a variety of different courses on health law and policy. And before that, I was executive director of the New York State Task Force on Life and the Law, which is a commission in the New York State Health Department that develops policy recommendations on bioethical issues. And I've also served as a bioethics and law advisor at the World Health Organization in Geneva.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. Both very impressive resumes. Really excited to have you both on the podcast with us today and hear what you have to say and get your opinions and your takes. So what drew you both to the topic of misinformation in medicine, and what brought you two together to co-write this article?
Carl wrote a really important article in Health Affairs. I'm not going to get your title exactly right, but it was something like medical licensing and misinformation. Be careful what you wish for, something like that.
Something along those lines.
Right. And it was a really important article for me and us at the American Board of Internal Medicine, because Carl was reflecting on some of the challenges that state licensing boards have in addressing physicians putting out misinformation at precisely the time that ABIM had made a decision that we regarded it as unprofessional and unethical if doctors we had certified were putting out things that were flagrantly untrue. This is in the summer of 21, and we're in the middle of the pandemic, and we thought if people put out advice that looks like medical advice, that patients relying on it are much more likely to be harmed than to be helped. We thought that was unethical and unprofessional, and we announced that we would consider using our disciplinary process to potentially revoke certification from doctors who did that. And it's a process. People have notice and they have opportunities to respond. And at the final phase of the process, they have opportunity to be represented by counsel and call witnesses and all that. But fundamentally, we were saying this is unprofessional and unethical. We'll take action against your certificate. And Carl's article was a really interesting counterpoint to think about what the challenge facing state licensing boards was.
Yeah, and I would say that the topic for me arose out of some of the statements that I was seeing at the beginning of the pandemic that physicians were making that just seemed outlandish about, vaccines contain microchips and tracking devices and will magnetize you, things that were just obviously false. But I, at the same time, I was a little bit concerned by some of the reactions to them, where people were suggesting that medical boards should just strip people of their licenses whenever they say anything that was inconsistent with the standard of care, which seemed to me to be potentially going too far. And the challenge really is how do you draw the line between acceptable limitations on unprofessional conduct and chilling legitimate debate.
And Carl, having opened that conversation with his article, we had some conversations, and I realized that one of the challenges facing certifying boards is the way in which many physicians today take for granted that everybody knows their experts, everybody knows their doctors, everybody knows the difference between them and everybody else. But actually, there's a whole administrative and legal superstructure that makes that possible that doctors haven't thought much about, and Carl clearly was an expert in, and that led to the two of us talking and putting together what became this article.
Yeah, awesome. So, you know, before we dive into what you touched on briefly as far as expertise and the misinformation piece, can you give us a background in terms of what is this intertwining medicine and law, and how did we get to be where we are today?
Well, I'll take something on the expertise and turn it back to Carl to talk about medicine and the law. I read a book that was very influential for me by Tom Nichols called The Death of Expertise. And he's somebody who's on the Naval War College faculty. I suspect we don't agree on much politically. But he was saying that we're living at a time where people are questioning the value of expertise. And at the American Board of Internal Medicine, some of your listeners may know, and some of them may be hearing from faculty, that all sorts of things about the board. People say that the board, in the most blunt terms, I've heard people describe the board as a corrupt, money-grubbing monopoly that's extorting money from physicians. And that is not, I think, a very accurate description of ABIM, but it's one that I've heard from more than one colleague and more than one doctor out there. And I realized that the very expertise that we were attesting to by issuing a board certificate was under assault, under attack. That should mean that the certification was even more valuable, as people needed to know who experts were. But a realistic look at the world we're in found a discovery that doctors are not immune from doubting expertise, even though we make a living by being experts. And I think Carl can reflect some on how many of the things that we get to do as doctors are the product of an interaction with the legal and political system.
Yeah, I would say that the very concept of medical professional oversight and licensing really emerged in frankly a similar environment in the 19th century, when there was really a lot of concern that people were holding themselves out as healers and as medical practitioners and didn't really have anything scientifically sound to offer. And states began to require licensing of practitioners based on standards that they thought were representations of legitimate expertise. So educational requirements, testing of qualifications, review of whether people's qualifications were really legitimate. And that was a way to basically separate professionals who could be trusted from people who couldn't be trusted, and recognizing that your average patient has no real way to know whether the person they're entrusting their health to has the expertise that they claim to have. So that's really the premise of the entire licensing and oversight system, is the idea that there is such a thing as expertise and that states are responsible for ensuring that certain standards are met. But we see now a growing sense that the very idea of deferring to expert knowledge is being called into question. People are increasingly taking the view that there really is no such thing as an objective fact, that everything is a matter of opinion, everything is a matter of politics, and that's the environment that leads to some of this questioning and the spread of misinformation.
Yeah, so, you know, from both of your perspectives, with, I guess, as you seem to imply that misinformation has sort of brought us, has been sort of the origination of what brought us to where we are in terms of medical licensure and certifications. So it seems like it's been around for a long time, but what has really brought it to the forefront in the recent years? Why is it in the limelight now?
Carl, you wanted to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of factors. It's hard to pinpoint one thing. I think certainly the political environment hasn't helped. That the idea that that facts are what you make of them, that there's this concept of facts and then alternative facts, and people can say things that are demonstrably untrue and continue to maintain them even when there's proof that they're not true. I think another aspect of it, which is probably overall a very good thing, is that it's much easier now for people to access information directly, so that some of the barriers to knowledge that used to exist aren't there anymore. So that, for example, anyone can go online and find a lot in the medical field, a lot of medical research and evidence that used to be completely inaccessible to the average person. And that's great. I mean, that's overall a very good development, but it's hard sometimes for people to appreciate that simply having access to information doesn't necessarily make you qualified to interpret it, and that not all interpretations of information are equally valid. So I think there is that sense that people don't need experts anymore because we can do our own research, but simply having access to the information doesn't mean the research is going to be of the same quality.
And I think another important trend that's building on what Carl just said of the information ecosystem, not only can people get access to lots of information, but it's clear that they are capable of constructing their own information bubbles where they're surrounded by people who agree with them and where they're seeing information that is the information that they're most likely to agree with anyway. So it's the phenomenon of confirmation bias kind of amplified and on steroids, that people seek out information that makes them feel good about what they believe, and they're able to construct very insular information universes. And at the end of the day, Paul Starr has a great line in The Social Transformation of American Medicine, a history of how doctors went from being economically marginal, socially marginal figures in the late 18th century at the founding of the country to having the prestige and authority and incomes that we have today. And he says, physicians derive their authority not by individually received expertise, but by being part of a learned community that has recognized that expertise. Science is always a we, not an I. But at the point at which that community can be constructed in any way anybody wants, people can wind up being citizens of communities in which all sorts of wackadoodle ideas are thought to be mainstream. And then they look around and they say, well, that's what my world looks like. So there's a way to construct a community to validate your ideas. It's not just that you can get information.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense in terms of the role that our licensing and certifying boards play. Is what have you seen in your role in terms of how you sort of manage and regulate that misinformation at your level? And I guess a follow-on question would be state licensing boards. What is their power, and how does your power as the certifying board, you know, coordinate with the state licensing boards?
So I'll take the certifying board question and then turn the licensing board question to Carl. Certifying boards are a uniquely American thing, and I'm licensed in Pennsylvania, and what my license says is that I'm a licensed physician and surgeon. And as far as Pennsylvania is concerned, that means that from their point of view, I can replace a heart valve, deliver chemotherapy, deliver a baby, replace a brain. I can do all those things as a matter of licensure. What actually keeps me from doing that in the U.S. is if I go down the street to Pennsylvania Hospital and I say, I feel like replacing a heart valve today, they're going to say, show me that you were trained to do that. Show me that a third party validated that you have the skills to do that. That's what board certification is. So it functions in the medical system as a credential, as a way to differentiate people who have demonstrated that they have a set of skills and it's been independently validated by a third party at the specialty level. So physicians, we in the U.S. have constructed different specialties. Your colleagues are going to decide if they want to train in pediatrics or OBGYN or surgery or internal medicine. Each of those is a separate board, and there's a discipline overseeing the specifics of that specialty, and people throughout the country rely on it to tell them who they can trust to do that particular kind of work. You can't be certified if you're not licensed. Licensing is something different. And let me ask Carl to talk about the licensing.
Since licensing boards are government agencies, they're bound by the Constitution, and so they're state actors. For purposes of misinformation, what's relevant is that the First Amendment protection of free speech applies to licensing boards. It does not apply to certification organizations. So there's the certification organizations have a lot more leeway in their regulation of misinformation. Licensing boards are more constrained, but they're not completely precluded from taking action in this area. One thing that they clearly can do is when physicians spread misinformation in the context of caring for patients, that's simply a part of the practice of medicine, and the courts have been clear that speech that is part of the practice of medicine can be regulated like any other aspect of medical practice. So, for example, if a physician gives someone bad medical advice, the fact that they're giving that advice through words doesn't mean that they're protected. It's not free speech, and they can't be held accountable for that. What gets more tricky is when you have physicians who are spreading misinformation not in the context of a physician-patient relationship, but, say, on social media or in a letter to a newspaper or in a public speech or something like that. There, the issue is trickier, and there really is no case law directly on point as to what the limits of board's authority in that area are. I believe that even in that context, there are some circumstances where even though this would be a direct limitation on public speech, boards would be justified in taking action. And I think those circumstances would arise if a physician knowingly spreads objectively false information. And we've seen examples of that. There haven't been that many examples, but there are enough to show that this is a real problem.
Yeah, I guess, Dr. Barron, can you speak to what the American Board of Internal Medicine has done, or I guess what it looks like currently as far as how you regulate physicians' speech and misinformation?
So we are, when we think about that, we first of all don't position ourselves as presuming to comprehensively regulate physician speech. We're not in a position to do that. When we announced our policy position that we would regard this as unprofessional and unethical and would use a decades-old disciplinary process for this purpose, a lot of people reached out to us and said, I'm worried about Dr. X or Dr. Y or Dr. Z. And our staff was able to look into some of those allegations and some of those concerns and put together various kinds of dossiers of what we could learn about the doctor from public information. So it's not a comprehensive process. It's a process that happens through reporting. we're able to do some level of investigation. Our process is confidential, so we don't announce that we're doing this. We will, the first level of the process is to send a letter to a doctor saying, this has come to our attention, we've done a preliminary investigation, we're concerned about X and Y and Z, and you have an opportunity to provide additional information to us. Second level of our process involves a staff committee of physicians and others considering that information and deciding whether they think that should generate a sanction. And if the recommendation is certification be revoked or suspended, then the doctor gets a letter notifying them that that's the recommendation of the staff committee, and they have an opportunity to appeal. It's at the appeal stage that they can go to a panel of three physicians, one of whom is a board member, representation by counsel, ability to call witnesses, introduce evidence, and the decision of that group is final as far as AVIM is concerned. People can and have taken us to court, and one of the questions that arises, as Carl was saying, is do we have the ability to do that? And at least so far, courts have taken the position that we're not a government agency, we're a private organization. We get to set standards. That's what we're supposed to do. We get to judge whether people meet those standards. And as long as we're running a process that's fair, courts have supported our ability to do it. So, as I said, it's a confidential process, but in the current environment, what is happening, you know, it used to be if somebody got a letter like that, it was the last thing they'd want anybody to know about, and they would keep it confidential too. But part of what's happened in the transformed universe is people are going very public with correspondence like that, and doctors who've gotten letters from us have posted them on Twitter, have put them in various public databases, and have activated various politicians and media figures. One doctor who, and again, we won't name any names. One doctor got a letter and did an interview with Alex Jones on InfoWars, spending an hour talking about how terrible the American Board of Internal Medicine was. Laura Ingram tweeted that our activities in this area showed that the boards are controlled by Marxists. And we received some death threats and had to up our security game, which is what we're hearing from anybody taking on disinformation these days, and whether it's in the public health space or the practice space or the Twitter space, it's become highly politicized. And going back to Carl's statement from before, in a world where people think there's no such thing as a fact and it's all political and you're just choosing political sides here, it's very difficult to get across the position that what we're trying to do is oversee the evidence-based practice of medicine and differentiate doctors who are following an evidence base and guiding what they do from doctors who are not.
Yeah, so, you know, you guys have referenced multiple times this sort of affront on medical expertise and the profession and sort of a misunderstanding of what the actual facts are. And your article discusses what you call an article, a larger movement to undermine the concept of expertise and the institutions that validate it, which I think is what you've described very succinctly here. But, you know, my question would be, how do we define expertise? Because I think what an expert may mean to me is very different from what an expert means to the public, or what an expert even means in the legal profession.
I can certainly talk about how the board defines expertise and then defer to Carl on how the concept works in law and policy. But the way the board defines it is we believe that kind of modern medicine, as we've understood it in the last 100 years plus, went from people just kind of throwing spaghetti at walls and seeing what stuck to a much more systematic approach to the generation of knowledge. And so we really committed to, not to use a fancy word, a form of epistemology, a form of how do you decide what's true. And that form involved the use of statistics, involved the use of designed clinical trials, involved designs like placebo-controlled trials or double-blind trials. And we came to believe as a profession that that was a reliable and safe way of generating new knowledge that could guide practice. So when we at ABIM are defining expertise, we're basically saying people who are in possession of the knowledge generated by those kinds of methods within a particular discipline. So cardiology has its journals, and peer reviewers are applying those kinds of standards to the stuff that they're publishing. And when the fundamental thing we do is give an exam. The exam has right and wrong answers. It turns out the hardest thing on an exam is a wrong answer. It has to be plausible, but it has to be definitively wrong. And we convene committees of prominent doctors who distinguish themselves in research practice teaching around the country to argue over, well, Dr. Zahn, you say that answer C is wrong, but I've got a paper here in a legitimate journal that could make answer C right. At the point at which that happens in that conversation, C is gone as a wrong answer, and a group has to come up with another answer. So for us, our certificate means that people have mastered that body of expertise, and that's what makes them an expert. And we have additional expectations that they behave in professional ways, that they continue to study, that they demonstrate proficiency over time. But at the core, and you asked what's our definition of an expert, it's someone who's in possession of a body of knowledge that has been generated using certain methods that we collectively believe generate safer, more reliable practice.
Yeah, and I would echo those points about really the method being critical to expertise, even more so than the content. And I often refer to a definition by Professor Claudia Haupt at Northeastern University, who has referred to the medical profession as what she calls a knowledge community. And she defines that as a community that has shared notions of validity and a common way of knowing and reasoning. And it's really a commitment to that method and the way of determining what is true and what isn't that is critical. And that doesn't mean that there's always going to be high-quality empirical evidence supporting every possible situation. There's a lot of uncertainty in all areas, including medicine. There are gray areas. There are areas where there are differences of opinion that are legitimate, and that's what really the challenge is in many situations. That it's not the case that everything can be backed by a peer-reviewed study. But this idea of a community that is committed to basically an approach for dealing with those situations, given the uncertainties, what are the ways of thinking about what the options should be and reasoning in the face of uncertainty. But within the areas of uncertainty, there really needs to be a pretty broad scope of deference to legitimate opinions that are based on reasonable inferences from information that's available. That's very different than just making things up and saying that empirically proven facts are false. And that's the line that needs to be maintained.
And to echo one of the things that Carl said, some of the pushback to the board for taking this on has been, gosh, there are so many areas of uncertainty. How do you know what's true? Aren't you just going to pick a side in some debate about which there's uncertainty? And I can't emphasize enough that the board's instructions were we would only do this when people were saying things that were categorically wrong and had impact, were out there and having harmful impact on patients and the public. And that's a high standard. That in a conversation with an oncologist who was a member of a large oncology group, he saw our position statement and he reached out and he said, this is terrible what you're doing. We have passionate debates in breast cancer about the right way to manage breast cancer. And are you really going to take a side in that argument? To which my response was, I understand that, doctor. That's not what we're trying to do. If you saw a woman in your group who had foregone treatment for breast cancer in the last 2 years and in favor of being treated with magnets, would you say, well, that's just a good faith difference of opinion? Or would you say, no, that's wrong? And of course, he said, no, that's wrong. That's not within the spectrum of what a legitimate oncologist would do. That's the space we're trying to defend. And sometimes people make the argument that because there's so much uncertainty, you can't find a space where there is certainty. And we categorically reject that.
Right. So I guess, you know, as a sort of a governing body in terms of expertise, you're really looking at the extremes, you know, the blatant disregard for safety or what is believed to be true within the profession.
That is where we are positioning ourselves. And we're concerned when people leverage the fact that they have our credential and they say, you should believe me because I've been certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine, and then they say something that's completely untrue, and a federal judge picks it up, or Congress picks it up. And when you talk about, and we can get into this if you want, and Carl will have more to say on it than I would, but in the most recent mifepristone decision from Judge Kaczmarek, there are many concerning things if you actually read the opinion. But for me, one of the most concerning is that he makes the argument that the drug causes harm, and he cites a bunch of numbers about the harm that the drug has caused. And the person he's citing is a former congressman who was a businessman, who, by the way, got kicked out of Congress after admitting to an affair with a married staffer. But he doesn't cite a doctor. He doesn't cite a study. He doesn't cite anything that has any credible methodology. And so you start to see a world where people are making stuff up who have no expertise and no ability, and it's influencing policy. And we want to be sure that people can recognize doctors who are trained in a different way and who will guide their practice and their guidance to the public by that kind of knowledge generation.
Yeah, Professor Coleman, do you mind? Because this was an article in JAMA that came out just, and the court decision was just last month, correct, on mifepristone. Do you mind giving us just a quick background on that case? And, you know, you referenced it in your article as well, how state legislature or even the judiciary system is sort of affronting this previously upheld deference to expertise.
Yeah, I mean, basically, just the bottom line of the case was you have a federal judge making a decision to overturn the FDA's approval of a medication that was made decades ago for a medication that is widely established to be safe and effective. It's the first time a court has taken on the authority to overturn an FDA's determination of safety and efficacy, and so just that fact alone is part of what has provoked such a strong reaction. Aside from the, you know, the impact in terms of access to medication abortion, it's the potential impact on really the whole regulatory apparatus of drug approval. If safety and efficacy is something that really does require quite a bit of expertise and is based on a very long and elaborate process. And if a single federal judge can just say that he doesn't agree with it, then what happens to our entire drug oversight system? And the article, we didn't talk about the case because the case hadn't been decided at that point, but we pointed to other legal decisions that have also really stepped into debates that really aren't debates that either legislatures or courts have the expertise to be involved in. So, for example, some states have enacted laws that prohibit medical boards from taking action against physicians who prescribe ivermectin for the treatment of COVID, despite the fact that it has been well established that ivermectin is completely ineffective for treating COVID. So this was clearly just a political move that disregards the idea of expertise. And there are other examples that we discuss in the article of developments, whether in state legislatures, in Congress, in courts, to really displace expert decision-making in favor of popular political decisions.
Yeah, I guess, do you think that there's a way to get, to sort of merge these definitions of expertise? Do you think there's a way that the public and the judiciary system and these professions can merge our definition of expertise? Is that even possible in today's society?
I don't know if it's so much a definitional issue or as much as a rejection of the concept. The idea that some people seem to oppose the idea that there is a group of people who have authority that can make decisions that other people are not entitled to make. I think the view, we discussed this in the article, that the assertion of expertise is seen by some people as simply a way for elites to maintain their power. And it's a kind of anti-elitism movement.
And I think it's important for experts to recognize, to some extent, the limits of their expertise, it's important to recognize that a method that undergirds a lot of what we do in clinical medicine is a statistical method that says that people who choose treatment A are more likely to have a good outcome than people who don't, or people who choose treatment B. But more likely is not the same as you're going to have that outcome. And your colleagues, as they interact with patients over the course of their career, will be making therapeutic recommendations to patients. It's important to have a certain amount of humility about that, because the patient doesn't care that 70% of people had the outcome. They care about the outcome that they have. And that's true at a social policy level, too, that there are choices that we're going to make that will have different costs. And there's no question that lockdowns and shutdowns had economic costs. There's also no question that they saved lives. And how you balance that, last I looked, we still have 50,000-60,000 people a year dying from COVID. That's down from 125,000 a few years ago. That's still more than we see in the average flu season. The decision that we're going to tolerate that to be able to go to the movies and go out to eat, there's no book you can look up in whether that's the right trade-off to make. I think there does need to be, political authority has an important role when it comes to the societal consequences of certain kinds of decisions. That's why these things are shared. But I don't want to live in a world where political authority pays no attention to expertise, where political authority isn't thinking at all about what experts are saying. I think that's a very dangerous place to be as a society.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point. As far as, the deference to expertise, I guess I wonder, with the courts now sort of deciding or influencing what standards of care are, contrary to what expert opinion may be, do you envision, a society or a scenario where, given that state licensing boards are a government agency, that there are 50 different standards of care across the United States for certain conditions? I mean, I guess like the example that comes to my head is the provision of abortion services, which is obviously like a very pretentious or very contentious topic. But I guess how do you see the political sort of affecting how physicians can carry out their jobs?
Well, I mean, we already see that. And another issue to consider is a politicization of the licensing boards themselves. And one example that comes to mind is the licensing board in Florida, which recently issued an opinion saying that treatment of a provision of gender-affirming care for minors consistent with accepted medical standards violates a standard of care in Florida. This seems to be clearly a politically driven outcome. And so I think it's very likely we're going to see different standards of care adopted, whether it's by politicized boards, by legislatures, by courts. I think that's the direction we seem to be going in.
And if I could shift gears a little bit, I think a lot of the root cause of both how the authority is being questioned by courts and legislatures and fundamentally how it's being questioned by citizens, which I think is the group that in some ways really matters here. I think the root cause is a loss of trust and a sense that, you know, we in healthcare think of ourselves as doing what we do for our patients. And that begins in the earliest parts of medical training and white coat ceremonies, reminding of the Hippocratic Oath and the selflessness of being a physician. But if you step out of our world and into the world that many patients are living in, pick your poison, you could talk about the absence of health equity in this country. And if you're in a population of color, you're not getting the same care everybody else is. You can legitimately say, I'm not sure this system is taking care of me. If you are experiencing the leading cause of personal bankruptcy in the United States because you went to an emergency room and ran up $5,000 in charges and then had them turned over for collection, you can say, I'm not sure the people in that hospital have my interests at heart. I think they may have their interests at heart. And I don't think we're doing a great job being trustworthy as a healthcare system right now. And frankly, I don't think the political system is being very trustworthy. And so when citizens start to lose trust in institutions, then they're willing to believe lots of things and things that they're willing to say, I don't really care what your study shows. I have every reason to believe that listening to you hasn't worked out so well for me before in the past. So I do think we have to pay more attention to that. We can't presume as healthcare providers and as health systems and as hospitals, we can't presume that we deserve to be trusted. In fact, I think we need to behave in ways every day that actively seek to generate that trust. That's another way that I think the board functions, is that credential is meant to mean something. It's meant to be something people can rely on. We can't take responsibility for every clinical practice act of every diplomate in the country, but we can take responsibility for having a program that says something meaningful about that doctor. And that's part of the profession trying to maintain trust with the public. We will put forward people who have been well-trained, who are staying current in the field, who are being guided by these principles. And in that sense, it's a label, it's a designation that becomes part of a trust equation. It's only part of a trust equation, but I think all of us have opportunities to do more to work on behaving in trustworthy ways.
Yeah, I think the issue of trust really is underlying this entire discussion. And in fact, when I said earlier that I think there is a role for even state licensing boards to take action against truly egregious cases of misinformation, the main reason is the importance of doing that to maintain public trust in the profession. If people don't have the assurance that physicians who deliberately lie to them or who are so reckless with the truth that they take information that has been questioned by every reasonable medical authority and is supported by no evidence whatsoever and disseminated as if it's the truth, and will face no professional consequences, then that's a recipe for losing trust in the profession. So licensing boards really have a strong case for saying we need to do something in these situations and prevent people who do this from calling themselves doctors.
Yeah, I think you guys both brought up, you know, a great takeaway point from this in terms of the health, the equity in healthcare across America, sort of degrading the trust in our profession. And like you said, the boards trying to uphold that trust, you know, it sounds like, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the boards do have the power to uphold the legitimacy of their profession. I guess, what does the future of that look like in our current society? How is that more regulation? Is that, I mean, you are already obviously taking steps to maintain the legitimacy of the profession, but is there more that can be done?
So I think one of the most important things we could be doing as a profession is maintaining coherence within our own fields, and frankly, supporting the institutions we've created to do this work. So one of the things, as I said earlier, I was subject to a bunch of attacks, and in many ways, we had fallen out of relationship with the doctors that we were certifying, and we were distant, we were arrogant, we were not connected. So there were ways we had lost trust from the doctors we were overseeing, and a lot of our work over the last decade has been to try to rebuild some of that trust. I think this is not a good time for physicians particularly to be dismantling the institutions that they've put together to assure the integrity of the discipline, to make and keep promises to the public. And I get that there are lots of arguments that even doctors make of this isn't necessary, or this is self-serving, or this is. And I think it's times like this that we really do need to understand, you know, what I'll call the broader threat. I think we're not that far from a world where patients take a look at the whole thing, citizens take a look at the whole thing, and they say, you know, I can go to Google and figure out what's wrong with me, and I ought to be able to walk into CVS and buy what it takes to fix it. And the only reason I can't is because of an extractive monopoly that the medical profession has interposed between me and my free rights. And I think that narrative has a lot more traction than our colleagues believe. And I think that's a narrative that deeply questions whether doctors are behaving in the interests of their patients. And I think we all need to do that. I think we need to support organizations that are doing that. I think we need to take public stands that are on the sides of the patients. And I think we need to be skeptical of the institutions that we have when they're self-serving and they're out there lobbying for higher payment for this and higher payment for that in a world where our patients are making a lot less than we are already. And I think we need to realize that the privileges and opportunities that we have to contribute to the health of our community are contingent on our being trusted to do that work. And if we lose that trust, we're really in trouble.
Yeah, that trust that you're describing is like one of the core components of us as a profession, right? Is that contract with the public and trying to maintain that. I guess to close it out, I wanted to ask, what can we as individuals, do you have suggestions or recommendations for what we as individuals can do to combat misinformation with our patients or to support, you know, upholding the legitimacy of the profession?
Well, I'll take a quick crack at that and invite Carl to contribute whatever perspective he might have. But first of all, your listeners, they're medical students, they're people early in training. They're all people who will have careers as physicians. And the first thing to appreciate is people will really pay attention to what they say. They may not feel like it on any given day, and they may feel disrespected and downtrodden and overworked and all sorts of nobody cares, but they will have voices that have more impact than lots of other voices. And so I think the first thing I'd say is they should use them. They should be when they're on social media, when they're on Facebook, when they're on Twitter, they should be clear about what things are medical facts and what things are not. And where there are differences of opinion, that's fine. But I think people really need to speak out. I had a conversation with FDA Commissioner Bob Califf, who said, you know, we need a future with tens of thousands of truth tellers, and your colleagues can be in that truth telling community. They can be, and they should be careful that they should understand what the bounds of that community are and operate within it, which I think was a point Carl was making earlier, that it is the idea of a learned community that gives rise to this. And if you're going to take a position at variance with the community, be really clear that you're taking this position at variance with the community. My patients used to ask me if I thought vitamin C was good for colds, and I was aware of no evidence that vitamin C was good for colds, but I would always say Linus Pauling, who won the Nobel Prize twice, he thinks vitamin C is good for colds. I haven't won the Nobel Prize at all, but you should know I don't have any evidence that that's effective. And I think contextualizing information that we give and being especially careful when we're pushing the edge of an envelope and doing something different than other people would recommend. I think that's an important thing to do. I think to work through their institutions to try to push the institutions to behave in more trustworthy ways, I think students and trainees have more power than they might think.
Yeah, I mean, I have very little to add to that. I would agree with everything that Richard just said. I think the point I would emphasize is that doctors should really appreciate the power of their words, and that everything they say will be filtered through the lens of the fact that they're a doctor. And so to recognize that power and to use it for good.
Awesome. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for coming on the podcast. I really appreciated this conversation with you both today and your thoughts and perspectives. Would love to have you back on later down the road.
Well, Andrew, we admire your energy and enterprise for creating a podcast, for building an audience, for finding us, giving us a chance to be on it. And you're demonstrating the kind of thing that medical students and healthcare people can do, finding ways to get good information out there in fair ways. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Absolutely. It was really a pleasure speaking with you.